Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist, Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the murders of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson in this series called Death in L.A. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast Pod. You can find me on most social media platforms under any one of those monikers. If you would like to help support the show, there's a couple ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast and make a one-time donation. If you really enjoy what I do and want to be considered one of the cool kids, you can be like my friends Channel and Anthony, who are the first two members of the Patreon family, and go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon for as little as $2 a month. You can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content. You can also get access to the exclusive content via Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe there. I think it's $2.99 a month on Apple Podcasts. I do not put any of the early ad-free shows on up there, but I do put the episodes from the exclusive content, such as Vince McMahon and the Columbine shooting, up on the Apple Podcast feed for subscribers. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax, get yourself a drink. If you're at work, I hope this helps you get through the week. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last week talking about the relationship between O.J. Simpson and his ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson. I played the most infamous of the 911 calls where Nicole, she's separated from O.J. She's not living at the South Bundy residence yet. She's at a different location, and O.J. Simpson has been to the house once. He comes back. He's busted down doors. He's ranting and raving in the background about prostitutes and drugs and his wife performing sex acts in the living room in full view of the children. And now we're going to move into the events of June 12th, 1994. Now, most of this information is taken from the official police reports, but as well, it's taken from trial transcripts and the book that was written by the lead detectives on the O.J. Simpson murder trial and investigation, entitled Evidence Dismissed, The Inside Story of the People vs. O.J. Simpson, by Tom Lang, Philip Van Adder, and Dan Moldy. Now, on the night in question, June 12th, O.J. Simpson met up with Nicole Brown Simpson and his former in-laws at the children's school where she was having a dance recital. Now, according to statements O.J. later gave, the family was preparing to go out to dinner after this, and Simpson was asked if he wanted to attend. He declined, as he did have a pre-existing trip planned for Chicago where he was going to take part in a charity golf event. Now, the family would later deny that Simpson spoke to them or was invited to attend this meal, which took place at Mezzaluna Restaurant. Now, the timeline going forward is going to be a little choppy because multiple witnesses gave different times that are usually within a half hour of one another. It's known that somewhere between 6:30 and 7 p.m. that night, Brown and a party of 10 went to the Mezzaluna restaurant where they had a reservation. As the story goes, the family left at around 9 p.m. that night and went their separate ways, with Brown going and stopping at an ice cream store with her children before heading back to the South Bundy address, and her parents going back to their home in Laguna Niguel, which is a drive of roughly an hour to an hour and a half. And again, we have questions raised even on this particular timeline, as an independent researcher did research concerning the Browns' drive back to their home. And after contacting the city of Los Angeles, this researcher discovered that it was not possible for the Browns to have reached their home within an hour or even an hour and a half, due to the fact that there was planned construction on the main roads that the Brown family took. And I'm bringing this up because this individual, who was, and the last I was aware, still is a doctor in the Los Angeles area, he wrote a book as well as a documentary called Serpents Rising that raises some interesting questions. However, I want to preface this by saying that no independent researchers of this doctor and his brother, of their work, exists. And I mention all of this because I try and be a completist when it comes to this show. Now, according to this doctor, the Brown family could not have reached their home before 11 p.m. Why is that important? Well, according to Mezzaluna Restaurant and the Brown family, Judith Brown contacted both the restaurant and her daughter, Nicole, at some point before 10 p.m. after they had gotten home, because Judith Brown realized she had left her glasses at the restaurant. Ron Goldman, a waiter at the restaurant, who was known to have a social relationship with Nicole Brown Simpson, offers to bring the glasses to Nicole's house for Nicole so she can give them back to her mother. This raises numerous questions about the relationship between Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. From the outside looking in, my opinion, it appears that they had something much deeper than a friendship. We know that Ron Goldman was seen on at least one occasion driving Nicole Brown's car. He was seen with her in various places. Generally speaking, you don't let someone drive your car unless there is a more intimate relationship than being friends. Again, it has been suggested that there may have been, if not a full-on romantic relationship, possibly the blossomings of the beginnings of one. Others have also put forth the idea that Ron Goldman may, in fact, have been Nicole Simpson's drug dealer. I don't know whether or not that is true. It's doubtful that if he was, we will ever learn the truth of that particular matter. But what's important is he knows where Nicole lives. They have this relationship. He offers to bring the glasses to Nicole's bungalow. And according to the manager of Mezzaluna, he warns Ron before Ron leaves the restaurant at 9:45, 9:50 to be careful of his relationship with Nicole Brown Simpson. Now we're going to go over the timeline of events that the police outlined to their captain, Captain Gartland, and Lieutenant Rogers for June 12th. According to their notes, at 2:18 p.m., O.J. Simpson calls his wife Nicole's house and speaks to someone for 3 minutes and 9 seconds. Between 4:45 and 5 p.m., Nicole attends her daughter's dance recital at Paul Revere Middle School in Brentwood, with Simpson arriving a few minutes after Nicole. Simpson is known to have brought flowers for his daughter. Between 6:30 and 6:45 p.m., the recital officially ends. Remember, I mentioned earlier, Simpson stated that he had been invited to attend this dinner, but had, in fact, declined to attend. Other witnesses state that Simpson was not invited and became upset over this and left. At 7 p.m., Simpson arrives at his home on North Rockingham, and at 7:20 p.m., an individual living in one of the bungalows on Simpson's property by the name of Cato Kalin asks Simpson if he can use his jacuzzi, which Simpson grants him the right to do. Now, according to Kalin, at this time, OJ complained about the provocative clothing that his wife was wearing to their daughter's recital. Kalin also stated that OJ tells him that the relationship with Brown is officially over. At 8:40 p.m., Simpson goes to the bungalow where Cato is living and informs him that he had forgotten to shut the water off to the jacuzzi, a claim which Kalin states he refutes, informing OJ that he had in fact turned off the water. At roughly 8:45 p.m., Nicole Brown Simpson and her two children leave Mezzaluna Restaurant and head to Ben and Jerry's, which is across the street from the restaurant. There is also a friend of one of Nicole's daughters with them. At roughly 9 p.m., they go back to the Brown House at 875 South Bundy Street. And not long after this, that friend's parent arrives to pick their child up. At roughly 9:10 p.m., Simpson, who is dressed in a dark tracksuit, goes to Cato's bungalow and asks to borrow $20 so that he can tip the skycap at Los Angeles International Airport. Cato gives him this money. Between 9:15 and 9:30, Cato and OJ then drive to a McDonald's in Brentwood in OJ's Bentley, going through the drive-thru with Cato Kalin paying for the meal. Between 9:35 and 9:45, OJ and Cato return to OJ's house with Cato going back to his bungalow, and he states that he did not see OJ again for about 90 minutes. At roughly 9:37 p.m., Judith Brent contacts the Mezzaluna restaurant to inform them that she had lost her eyeglasses. After a few moments, an employee by the name of Karen Crawford informs Miss Brown that they have found the glasses outside in the street. At 9:40 p.m., Judith Brown calls her daughter to inform her about the glasses which have been left at the restaurant, and they speak for roughly 2 minutes. At 9:43 p.m., Nicole Brown Simpson contacts the restaurant and speaks with Ron Goldman, with Ron offering to drop the glasses off at Nicole's house after his shift ends. According to the manager, he informed Goldman that he didn't need to make a special trip to Brown's house to drop off the glasses, and this is when Goldman informs him that he has been seeing Nicole Brown Simpson, quote-unquote, socially, and again, according to the manager, he insists upon going and bringing the glasses to Nicole. At roughly 9:50, Goldman leaves the Mezzaluna restaurant with Nicole Brown Simpson's mother's glasses, and using a car he has borrowed from a friend by the name of Andrea Scott, heads back to his apartment where he showers and changes his clothing. It appears Goldman had plans to go and hang out with a friend after his shift had ended, and that he was simply swinging by Nicole's house quickly to drop off the glasses, possibly to make small talk, before heading out to meet with this friend. Goldman drives over to Brown's home, the location of which he already knows, and parks on the north side of Dorothy Street with the vehicle facing west near an alley. At 10:03 p.m., O.J. Simpson attempts to reach his girlfriend, Paula Barbieri, on his cellular phone. However, he is unable to make contact. Between 10:15 and 10:20, an individual by the name of Pablo Fenchvez, who lives behind Brown's condominium, notes that her dog is, quote-unquote, plaintively wailing. And now we're going to leave that timeline for the time being and move forward a hair to discuss the actual discovery of the bodies, and we'll get back to the timeline that the officers will establish in a few days to discuss the various points of it. At roughly 3 a.m. on the morning of June 13, 1994, two homicide detectives for the Los Angeles Police Department by the name of Tom Lang and Philip Van Adder are contacted by their shift supervisor, a lieutenant by the name of John Rogers. Rogers informs both men that they have a double homicide at 875 South Bundy Drive. Now, the area where these bodies are located is a fairly high-end neighborhood that really is not accustomed to seeing homicides of any nature, so immediately that raises the back hairs of both detectives. Further cause for concern is the fact that their lieutenant informs them that it's believed one of the victims may be the ex-wife of O.J. Simpson. Now, both of these men are used to working high-profile murder investigations, as they work for very specific part of the Los Angeles Police Department known as the Homicide Special Section. You may be familiar with both of these individuals from the series that I did on the Wonderland case. Both of these men were involved in that case. In fact, it was Tom Lang who wrote the book on the Wonderland crimes that I gleaned quite a bit of the information for that series from. Van Adder arrives at the crime scene at Bundy at roughly 4:05 a.m. and speaks with Officer Miguel Terrares, who is handling the crime scene log. Van Adder is then met by another homicide detective by the name of Ronald Phillips, who works for the West Los Angeles Police Department. And Phillips informs Van Adder that Terrares and another patrolman by the name of Robert Riske had arrived at the scene at 12:20 a.m., responding to a possible burglary across the street from the crime scene. Upon arriving at the scene, the officers were met by a young married couple by the name of Sukru Bozepe and Bettina Rasmussen. The couple explains that they had encountered a small white Akita dog with blood on its paws. They had followed the dog back to the location on South Bundy Drive, at which point they found the body of a woman lying on a walkway. Obviously, this isn't something that this couple was expecting to encounter. They quickly flee the scene and race to a neighbor's home. And it's this knocking on this neighbor's door that is mistaken as being a potential break-in. And this leads to the two uniformed officers being called out and the eventual discovery of Nicole Brown Simpson's body as well as the body of a young man. The two officers immediately contact dispatch requesting paramedics along with other police personnel to descend on the scene. What happens next will be a little bit of a source of contention as the men don't know for certain whether or not the victims are dead, and because of this, Officer Riske decides to walk through the crime scene, avoiding as best he can any of the blood. He shines his light on the male victim and notices that his eyes are wide open. Because of this, he reaches down and touches the man's eyes, hoping to get a reaction. Obviously, he does not, and it's at this point that the scene before them becomes a homicide investigation. Riske would later state that he did not bother to check the body of Nicole Brown Simpson, as it was apparent from the amount of blood and the injuries that he could see that the woman was obviously dead. Again, they contact dispatch requesting backup, and not long after this, two more officers, Edward McGowan and Richard Wally, arrive, along with their sergeant, Martin Kuhn. The five of them begin securing the scene of the crime. And not long after this, as they're securing the scene at 12:45 a.m., paramedics from a nearby fire station arrive and officially pronounce both of the victims dead. The point of contention that is later raised is why the paramedics had not attempted any life-saving measures on either of the victims. And the response was simply that it was obvious that neither of them had any chance of survival. They were already dead when the paramedics arrived, and there was no need to institute life-saving measures. Now, during this conversation with Officer Phillips, Van Adder is informed that the two officers originally on the scene had noticed a bloody left-hand glove near the body of the male victim, and that neither man had seen a similar matching glove anywhere else at the crime scene. Again, the two first responding officers had risked going up to the front door of the home, as it was wide open, and it was there that they found bloody shoe prints that were moving away from the two bodies down an alley and through a back gate, which was found to have blood transfers on it. The officers then conducted a door-to-door investigation, trying to see if anyone had seen or heard anything in the hours prior to the discovery of the bodies. From this door-to-door investigation, the officers are able to tentatively identify as the woman as being Nicole Brown Simpson. They quickly learn is the ex-wife of O.J. Simpson. These first responder officers also looked inside Brown's home. They found her children upstairs. They did not find any blood evidence inside of the home. However, they did find numerous photographs and paintings of O.J. Simpson, as well as an envelope that had Simpson's return address at 360 North Rockingham Avenue. Also noted that there were candles burning in the living room, as well as soft New Age music playing on the stereo. A large knife was on the countertop nearby the stove in the kitchen, and on a banister in the stairwell outside of the kitchen, over by the garage, was a cup of Ben & Jerry's chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream, which was still melting. There was a spoon placed next to the ice cream. Officer Riske uses the phone inside of Brown's kitchen to call for additional backup, and he later stated that he took this unusual step as he feared that the media may be monitoring the police bands on his radio. The officers end up getting the two children upstairs out of bed and dressing them, taking them out the back door, where it was arranged that they would be taken to the West Los Angeles Police Department's division until a positive identification could be made on not only their mother, but relatives located to care for the children. It was stated that the older of the two children, Sydney, repeatedly asked the officers, "Where's my mommy?" Officers also arranged for Nicole Brown Simpson's white Akita to be put into a pound in West Los Angeles until such time as the animal could be examined. The officers also established a safe route in and out of the crime scene in order to avoid it being contaminated or disturbed in any manner by those coming in and out of the crime scene. Officer Phillips informs Van Adder that he himself had arrived at the crime scene at 2:10 a.m., accompanied by Detective Mark Furman, with the two of them conducting a visual inventory of the crime scene. Remember the name Mark Furman, as he is going to come up again and again in this investigation, and in fact, some of the things that he may or may not have done in the years prior to the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman are going to come back and haunt the prosecution team as well as the state's case against O.J. Simpson. Phillips and Furman are listed on the timesheets for the crime scene as the 16th and 17th person on site. So just with that, you can tell that this is becoming a fairly massive crime scene that is going to draw media attention. Obviously, that is not what the police want, especially in these early stages of their investigation, as reporters tend to get in the way and muck things up for them. Now, at 3:25 a.m., a photographer for the Los Angeles Police Department arrived at the scene. This was Rolf Rokar. And it's interesting to note that until the detectives who were assigned the case arrived on scene, the photographer was only able to take pictures from afar. He wasn't allowed to really get on top of things, and that is part of the SOP of the LAPD, that nothing really can be done as far as the crime scene goes until the detectives in charge arrive. In this case, it was Lang and Van Adder. The caveat to that is if individuals from the SIDS team arrive, and SID is basically the CSI individuals for the Los Angeles County Police Department, if they're on scene prior to the lead detectives arriving, then things can begin to be processed to some effect, as the members of the SID team have overall authority over the crime scene, even above the detectives. Now, Van Adder gets a walkthrough of the crime scene at this point, and they note the paw prints from the dog leaving the yard and going down the sidewalk and then turning on to Dorothy Street, at which point the paw prints begin to fade. The detectives at this point are unable to really approach the bodies as a member of SIDS has not yet arrived, but they do take note of a few things. It's apparent that both victims have been stabbed and slashed to death, although at this point they don't know which of the two was the target. At least that is what the detectives state. They also make note of some items of interest near the body of the as-yet-unidentified male. A blue knit cap, a set of five keys, a beeper, and an envelope that is splattered with blood, along with the left-hand glove. Van Adder and Phillips began to speculate together at this point that it's more likely than not, given the fact that there is no evidence of blood inside of the house, that the killer or killers did not go into the residence and instead stayed outside. The officers go back inside and through the house from the back, at which point they can look at the crime scene from a different angle. They again take note of the shoe prints that are leading away from the crime scene, as well as drops of blood, which are trailing away from the crime scene westward towards the back alley. Detective Tom Lang arrives at the crime scene at 4:25 a.m. Lang then gets a walkthrough of the house. The officers speak to one another afterwards, and they agree that what they are seeing appears to be a case of overkill. According to logs kept, Lang states this isn't just some robbery, then a cut and run. These people were mutilated and stabbed. They were beaten. Just look at their slashed throats. This is a rage killing. Now, at some point during all of this, Lang and Van Adder are informed that they are to contact O.J. Simpson concerning the retrieval of his children from the West Los Angeles Police Department station where they are currently being kept. And it's because of this the officers learn that Mark Furman has had interactions with O.J. Simpson in the past. Furman was one of the individuals who had gone out to O.J.'s house on a domestic violence call. And it's at this point that the detectives inform Furman, since he has been there and has had interactions with Simpson, that they are going to go over to his house on Rockingham. Furman agrees to go with them. Lieutenant Rogers, who is Langan Van Adder's immediate supervisor, takes over the crime scene until the two detectives return. So it's Phillips, Furman, Langan, Van Adder who go to OJ's house. And at roughly 5 a.m., they reach the domicile with its high walls. And according to the two lead detectives, their plan is to meet with Simpson, give him the notification that his wife or his ex-wife has been murdered, where he can pick up his children and attempt to gain further cooperation in the future in regards to this case. Now, both officers later stated that at this early stage in the crime, they did not realistically consider O.J. Simpson to be a suspect. Yes, he is the ex-husband, so there is always that thought in their mind. However, given O.J.'s prominent status within society, they did not really look at him yet as a suspect. Driving up to the house, they make note that a 1994 Ford Bronco is parked out in front of the Rockingham estate, and that this Bronco isn't pulled up to the curb so much as it's pulled in with its rear end sticking out into the street. The officers follow Phillips and Furman, who go around the corner onto Ashford and park near a Nissan 300ZX. Approaching the gate that is on Bundy, the officers note there are two vehicles inside the semicircular driveway, a Bentley and a Saab, and it was Furman who hits the button on the intercom and attempts to get someone in the house's attention. There is no answer from the intercom despite repeated attempts to contact the individuals within the house. According to the officers, they could see lights on in the house, and initially they believed that the intercom might be broken. The officers are able to get a phone number for the security company that oversees the Simpson property. And as this is going on, a car from the security company that oversees OJ's property happens to drive by, sees the officers, and pulls up beside them. While the officers are talking with this security guard, Mark Furman goes over and checks out the Bronco that is sitting cockeyed with the curb. According to those present, they see Furman shine his flashlight in the rear window of the Bronco and then immediately call out to Van Adder. Now, what has drawn Furman's attention is what is in the back of this Bronco, a shovel and a plastic sheet, along with boxes marked with Orenthal Productions, which is the name of the company that O.J. Simpson owns. They also take note of the fact that the car is locked. It's at this point that Van Adder instructs Mark Furman to contact the Department of Motor Vehicles and run checks on the tags for both the Bronco and the Nissan. This is happening. The security guard is arguing with Lang and Phillips because he does not want to give out the phone number to O.J. Simpson. Van Adder approaches the man and demands that the phone number be given. This security guard contacts his supervisor, who in turn informs the security guard that yes, he needs to give the phone number over to the homicide detectives. The guard turns over the phone number and informs the detectives that, to the best of his knowledge, Simpson is inside the Rockingham property. It's at this point that the detectives learn that the Bronco is registered to the Hertz Corporation and that the Nissan is registered to Brian Gerard Kalin, also known as Cato Kalin, and that the vehicle is registered to an address that is not in the area. At this point, they don't know that Cato Kalin is in one of the bungalows on the Simpson property. Furman then goes over to the Bronco and continues his inspection, and it's at this point that he alerts the others that he believes he has found blood on the driver's side door. This is a small dot that is roughly the size of a dime above the handle on the driver's side door. After conferring with the others on scene, all of them agree that it's very possible that there is blood on the Bronco. Not knowing what is going on, whether this is coincidence or possibly connected to the murders, the officers then call the Simpson household. The time is roughly 5:36 a.m. The detectives later stated that they could hear the phone ringing inside the Simpson household, and afterwards, the answering machine kicks on. As the officers are trying to figure out what their next step should be, a patrol car sent over from the Bundy crime scene arrives at the Simpson household with two officers who have been sent over there specifically to give assistance in any way, shape, or form that the detectives on site may need. Van Adder has these officers contact the SID's office as he wants somebody to come out and examine the red spot that has been found on the Bronco. And it's at this point that the officers reach the conclusion that there's a good possibility that whatever happened at Nicole Brown Simpson's house has found its way to O.J. Simpson's home on Rockingham. And as they would later state in open court, it was their belief at this point in time that there was a possibility that O.J. Simpson and anyone else who might be inside of the house may be in danger or may possibly have suffered the same fate as Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman. And because of this, the next steps that they take, which are going to be heavily scrutinized in the months to come, become necessary for them to take to ensure that the individuals inside of this home are, in fact, safe. So Mark Furman volunteers to go over the wall at approximately 5:45 a.m., and it's Furman who opens the gate for the other officers. With the two patrolmen standing guard outside of the gate, the four detectives make their way onto the Rockingham property. Within the grounds, they encounter another Akita, which does not seem to be threatening in any fashion. The officers then go and ring the doorbell. Getting no response, they begin to knock on the door before deciding that it would be in their best interest to check the back of the house. And they go around the house, and it's in this going around the house that they encounter two bungalows. They notice someone moving inside one of the bungalows and pound on the door, which is answered by a disheveled-looking white male. They quickly ascertain that this man is Cato Kalin, who lives on the property, and that he has spent the evening on the property. Now, Furman is kind of aggressive here. He gives him a field sobriety test and then demands to see the clothing that Cato wore the previous evening, which he readily gives to the officers. Kalin informs the officers that, to the best of his knowledge, the only other person on the property is Simpson's daughter, Arnell, who lives in the bungalow next to the one that Cato lives in. The officers make contact with the occupant of the next bungalow, Arnell, who seems to have no idea of what is going on. After speaking with her for a few moments, they ascertain that the vehicle, the Bronco out in the road, belongs to O.J. Simpson. Arnell seems to be surprised that the officers have not been able to make contact with her father. According to the officers, when Arnell Simpson informs them that her father should be home, they immediately begin to suspect that foul play may in fact have taken place at the O.J. Simpson Rockingham estate. They ask Arnell if that she can give them access to the home. Phillips, Van Adder, and Lang follow Arnell Simpson to the home while Cato Kalin and Mark Furman remain at Kalin's bungalow speaking about the night. They do a quick sweep downstairs, and they do not notice any sort of struggle inside the main manor on the Simpson property. And it's at this point that Furman rejoins the group and informs them that someone needs to go and speak with Cato Kalin, as he has quite a story to tell. And Kalin is brought into the home and is questioned by Van Adder, while Furman goes back outside the property. This is where we get the story about Kalin and Simpson going to get McDonald's, Kalin giving Simpson money, Kalin paying for the food. Cato states that after returning to the property, Simpson went inside by himself. And then he tells the officers something that is going to become a sticking point in the coming trial, that somewhere around 10:45 a.m., while Kalin was on the phone with his girlfriend, he heard a loud noise coming from outside the back of the bungalow, which Kalin described as three bumps in rapid succession. Kalin states that he initially believed the noise was the result of an earthquake, as a picture frame on one of his walls had actually moved. Kalin gets a flashlight and heads outside the bungalow. And as he's exiting, he notices that there is a limousine sitting outside the Ashford Street gate. So Kalin goes and, ignoring the sound that he heard, opens the gate for the limousine driver, which allows the chauffeur to pull inside and park. It's from the driver that Kalin learns that the limo is there to take Simpson to LAX, and that Simpson was, in fact, late for their rendezvous. Not long after this, as Cato is speaking with the driver, Simpson comes walking out of the house, and Kalin and the limo driver give Simpson a hand loading his luggage inside of the limousine. Cato informs Simpson about hearing the three bumps and lets Simpson know that his flashlight doesn't work very well. Simpson takes a moment and attempts to find a flashlight for Kalin, although he is unable to find one. And at this point, the driver and Simpson leave for LAX. Not long after this, Simpson contacts Kalin using his cell phone and says to him that the three noises he heard has Simpson disturbed. He asks Cato to go into the main house and set the alarm. Kalin informs Simpson that he doesn't know how to do this, and Simpson then gives him instructions on how to set the alarm. The officers then ask Kalin if he has keys to the Bronco. Kalin says he does not, but he knows where Simpson keeps them. However, when he goes to check inside the house at a table, he is unable to find them. Arnell Simpson, on the other hand, is talking with the other detectives. She informs them that she had returned home in her Saab at about 1 a.m. from going to the movies, that she does not know where her father is, but that her father's personal assistant, Kathy Randa, may know where he is. And during all of this, she continues to ask the detectives what's going on and what is the matter. And it's from this personal assistant that they learn that Simpson is in Chicago. Arnell then gives the officers the phone number to Simpson's hotel in Chicago. And this would later become another talking point during the trial, as the defense is going to try and paint it that the officers suspect O.J. Simpson is responsible for the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Rod Goldman from the start, whereas they claim this is not the case and further point out that because they found out the location of O.J. Simpson from the personal assistant, they saw no reason to go anywhere else inside of the house, which makes sense if the officers do not believe at this point that Simpson is a suspect or person of interest. And it's at this point that the officers inform Arnell Simpson that her stepmother, Nicole Brown Simpson, has been murdered. And Arnell absolutely falls to pieces, saying over and over again that I gotta contact AC, I gotta call AC. AC Cowlings is O.J. Simpson's best friend and a former partner on various football teams who O.J. has remained close with in the years since his career ended. Arnell insists on contacting Cowlings while the officers are able to extract the phone numbers for Nicole Brown Simpson's family. Officer Phillips is the one who contacts O.J. Simpson in Chicago. They inform him that his children are fine, that his ex-wife is dead. According to the officers, O.J.'s response was something along the lines of, "Oh my God, Nicole is killed. Oh my God, is she dead?" Now, a couple things come from this. The officers find it very odd that Simpson does not ask what has actually happened to Nicole, what the circumstances surrounding her demise are, any of those things. Things that the officers later state a individual who does not have anything to do with a crime would typically ask, and I'm going to posit this response to that. Everyone has a different response when they learn about something happening to someone they care about or once cared about. And despite what the officers say, there is no textbook response from an individual upon learning that their ex-wife has died. And that is something else that needs to be taken into account, that Simpson and Nicole were no longer together. By Simpson's own words, they had attempted to reconcile it numerous times and come to the conclusion that it just was not going to work out. So to say that Simpson's responses were incorrect is, in my opinion, a fairly broad stretch, as there is no correct when it comes to learning about the demise of a loved one or a former loved one. But that being said, not having heard his tone of voice and only being privy to what officers stated O.J. said. Now, the officers inform O.J., as I said, that they have his children. O.J. wants to know why they're at the police station. They let him know that at the time they did not know that they were O.J.'s children, and they had nowhere else to take them. At which point, O.J. informs the officers that he is going to take the next flight out of Chicago to come back to L.A., and it is important to note that he offers to do this, as later on there would be some arguments about whether or not O.J. came back willingly, and if he did in fact come back willingly, that these are the actions of a man who is in fact not guilty. After this, Arnell Simpson speaks with her father briefly before informing the officers that it is she who will go and pick up O.J. and Nicole's daughters. Lang then contacts the Brown family. This is at 6:21 a.m. The phone is answered by Lou Brown, Nicole's father, and on another line, Denise Brown, Nicole's sister. According to Lang, upon hearing this, Denise Brown begins screaming, quote, I knew he'd do it. I knew that motherfucker would kill her. I knew it. I knew it. OJ did it. OJ killed her. I knew that son of a bitch was going to do this. She continues to scream this into the phone as Officer Lang attempts to calm the situation, informing Lou Brown that his grandchildren are safe at the police station and they will soon be picked up by Arnell Simpson. Afterwards, Judith Brown gets on the phone with the officer and recounts the night that the family had spent with Nicole, their grandchildren, and the fact that O.J. Simpson was in their presence at the recital. Upon getting off the phone with the Browns, the phone at the Simpson household rings, and Lang is surprised to hear O.J. on the other line, informing him that he is on his way back, and that he has been able to get a flight out. Now, as Lang is handling all of this, Cato Kalin and Detective Van Adder are still continuing to speak, going over the events of the night, at which point Detective Mark Furman, who has been gone for 10 to 15 minutes, re-enters the house and informs Van Adder that he has found something that Van Adder needs to see. They walk across Simpson's property to a chain-link fence, find an open gate in the fence, go through this into like a little alleyway that is covered by overhanging vegetation, and follow this down to another open gate which feeds out onto the sidewalk. Not far from an air conditioning unit that sticks out the back of Cato Kalin's bungalow, in what the officers assumed to be roughly the spot where Cato stated he had heard noises at around 10:45, Furman stops and informs Van Adder that he should turn on his flashlight. Lying on the ground in the shrubbery is a blood-stained right-hand leather glove. The officers immediately suspect that this glove is a match to the left-handed glove that they had seen at Nicole Brown Simpson's home earlier that morning. They also take note that there is a blue plastic bag lying against the fence not far from the glove. Leaving the glove and the bag where they found them, as they now consider the house at Rockingham to be a crime scene, both detectives return to the Simpson household, at which time Van Adder informs Furman that he wants the detective to return to the South Bundy Drive crime scene, telling him that he wants to take a good look at the glove and have photographers take pictures of this glove for later comparison to the one that they have just discovered. He also tells Furman that after the photographer is taking these pictures, to bring the photographer back to Rockingham Drive so that he can take pictures of the glove that they have found where they found it. Furman then takes Lang to look at the glove, and they return to the house at roughly 6:35 a.m. to find that A.C. Cowlings has arrived to pick Arnell Simpson up and bring her to the West Los Angeles Police Department to pick up O.J. and Nicole's children. At this point, Phillips and Furman leave the crime scene and head back to the South Bundy crime scene. Lang and Van Adder then reconnoiter in Simpson's driveway and begin discussing things, and both men reach the conclusion that they very possibly could have an extension of the Bundy crime scene at the Rockingham house, with Van Adder being the one to posit the idea that O.J. Simpson may very well be the suspect in this crime. Lang informs Van Adder of the conversation he has had with the Browns, and that Denise Brown believes O.J. is responsible for the death of her sister. He also states that there were other voices in the background, all of which exclaimed OJ did it, or similar sentiments. Lang and Van Adder continue to discuss the possible implications of all that they have learned in the last few hours before Lang informs Van Adder that he needs to get back to the South Bundy crime scene in order to begin processing the crime scene, stating that he is going to have one of the uniformed officers drive him back over there in the squad car, leaving Van Adder and the other patrolman at the Rockingham estate. At roughly 6:40 a.m., Detective Tom Lang and one of the patrolmen leave for the South Bundy crime scene. And it should be pointed out that, according to their own statements, at this point, Van Adder and Lang believe that Simpson is their main suspect. However, they both agree that without a search warrant, they cannot legally go inside of Simpson's home beyond the areas the family had allowed them into and begin searching for any incriminating evidence. Standing in the driveway, Van Adder looks down and sees another red spot similar to the one that was found on the driver's side door of the Bronco. This is in between the Bentley and the Saab. He quickly notes that it too resembles blood. Scanning the area, Van Adder notices similar drops leading away from the cars over towards the gate on the west side of North Rockingham, and eventually leads to the rear of Simpson's Bronco. Looking inside of the Bronco, now with daylight breaking, Van Adder sees that there is blood smears inside of the vehicle, specifically on the passenger side console and on the driver's side door. Retracing his steps, Van Adder finds that the blood spots do not stop at the Saab and Bentley, and in fact lead directly up to O.J. Simpson's front door. Shortly after this, Arnell Simpson and A.C. Cowlings return with O.J. and Nicole's children. They say nothing to the officer as they head inside of the house, and Van Adder is left to continue perusing the grounds. We are going to end this, our second look at the O.J. Simpson murder trial, the death of Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ronald Goldman at this point, with the early morning of June 13th having dawned, and the detectives having made contact with O.J. Simpson, the Brown family, and having found numerous items of evidence at O.J. Simpson's North Rockingham estate. I hope that you have enjoyed this second part, and if you did, I hope you will tell others about the show. Until next time, the Deathcast is a co-production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasting. Stay morbid!